Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
The race is on, and Lewis Hamilton made it 3 out of 4 with victory in a thrilling Spanish Grand Prix. But was it a race Max Verstappen and Red Bull should have won, or did Mercedes always have the edge? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to discuss another gripping Formula One race are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. The Race F1 podcast is brought to you by Escapade Living. Escapade is redefining the race experience through the integration of hospitality, track access, and lifestyle. Escapade Silverstone will overlook the famous Copps, Maggots and Beckett's complex and offer the ultimate private space that can be enjoyed with friends and family. It heralds a new era of motorsport adventures. To find out more, go to escapadeliving.com. No hyphens, just escapadeliving.com. Well, Mark, let's just get a big number out of the way, shall we, this weekend. 100 pole positions for Lewis Hamilton. A ridiculously high number. It seems landmark and significant because we like base 10 and 100 is a nice round. Ridiculous achievement, really, isn't it?
Yes. And, how would you even begin to sort of put them in any sort of order of merit? You can remember the outstanding ones. You remember Singapore. You can remember that one in the wet last year at the Styrian Grand Prix and a few others. But then, you know, it's just a blur. It's just this blur of enormous achievement. And, I'm always very reluctant to say that'll never be beaten, but I feel quite confident in saying that'll never be beaten in my lifetime.
Yeah, a subtle difference there. It is a massive number and requires an amazing set of circumstances, not just a quite brilliant driver, which Lewis Hamilton clearly is, but also the opportunity to rack up that number. But Scott, I think you asked Lewis about what it meant to him and he couldn't really work it out. So what does it mean to you?
Yeah, well, I'm just like I am with a lot of what he's achieved, what Mercedes has achieved, and I guess what we see in other sports as well. I just feel quite privileged to actually be here to see it happen, because I think just appreciating something like that being achieved is a huge part of what's so enjoyable about sport. And so when I asked Lewis about it, I said, you know, normally he's not taken aback by stats. He's not one for statistics, and obviously he's broken countless records. They probably all blur into one as well. But there is something about the century, isn't there? And I likened it to, you know, a cricketer who hits a century of runs, or a Premier League footballer who joins the 100 goal club. There's something about it that matters. And yeah, now after qualifying on Saturday, Hamilton could raise the metaphorical bat, couldn't he? He's hit his century of poles, and it's just, yeah, what Mark said. I can't see myself living through this again, which is one of the reasons why I'm so keen to just enjoy it while it's happening.
It's one of those things, it'll probably be beaten one day because records tend to be, but you just can't see a pathway for how it can possibly happen. An amazing achievement. It is a privilege, no matter which driver, to see great drivers performing at their best. That is what Formula One is all about. So just great to be able to enjoy it and appreciate it. And even for those who aren't necessarily fans of Lewis Hamilton, I think there's every reason to give him a quick applause as he raises his metaphorical Formula One car-based bat. But let's get on to the race. Now, Scott, normally we start with Mark's look at the bigger picture of how the race was won, but let's just zero in on a moment at the start of the race. First corner, another big moment in the Hamilton versus Verstappen battle. So what did you make of that moment?
Well, first of all, obviously it continues this amazing 100% record we've got. of these two going wheel to wheel in every race so far this season, which is just phenomenal. This one I felt was the strongest or hardest one, hardest move yet. It was an escalation in what we've seen so far. I still think it was just about in the realms of what's acceptable. It was very aggressive from Verstappen. Hamilton had a decision to make in the moment. Does he commit to his line, knowing that Verstappen's speed into the corner is almost certainly going to end in contact, which Hamilton wouldn't have been responsible for causing? Or does he live to fight another day and accept that Max has launched one that it's not worth getting in the way of? And obviously, as we know, Hamilton chose the latter. I think it was an excellent judgment call from him. There may come a moment later in the year where he decides, actually playing the odds, it's better to just turn in and give Max something to think about. But I think it was just about okay. And the fact that Hamilton obviously went on to hound Verstappen and ultimately win meant that Lewis could probably reflect on it quite positively as well. I think it was very, very hard racing. And because Max was up against someone like Lewis, it came off and it was okay.
Lewis said after the race that he's not a driver that gets involved in those incidents. He didn't need to have a collision. The really interesting thing, though, is if this just keeps happening, there's bound to come a reckoning, isn't there? A moment when Hamilton isn't willing to cede a little bit and maybe wants to lay down a marker in the sand. Do you think, Mark, that's almost inevitable? Given the current rates, another 19 races of this, there's going to be a point where he might think, particularly when we get down to the real run-in for the title, where he might need to be much more aggressive and not be the one that gives that little bit of extra space.
Yeah, no, with Lewis, it depends on the situation he's in. With Verstappen, it's much more binary. This is just how he does it. If it's a 50-50 situation, then he's got right of way. That's how he approaches it. Lewis is more sort of more global in how he does it. We've seen him avoid an accident a couple of years ago at Monza with Leclerc, when Leclerc got a little bit out of order. Lewis would have been perfectly entitled to keep his line and have the accident, but he chose not to because he was chasing the world championship. And he said then, no, I asked, what would you have done if the championship hadn't been at stake, if he'd already won it? And he said, well, I just stayed exactly where I was and we'd have had an accident, which is, perfectly legitimate way of going racing as well. I don't think Max was out of order on this occasion. I thought it was fine. It was hard. One of the fascinating things about this race is that when you trace it back, that move of Max won Lewis the race because of the way that the two cars work their tyres. When you work it all backwards, you come to that point of non-contact, and it's when that is the moment that Verstappen lost the race in hindsight.
Such is the way these races pan out. And although we had to wait a little bit longer for what feels like an almost inevitable moment of irresistible force meeting a movable object, which will be quite a spectacular battle between those two. But how exactly did Mercedes plot its course to victory from there then, Mark?
Mercedes suspected that this probably would be a one-stop race. Everybody else, including Red Bull, was absolutely sure it was going to be a one-stop. Last year was a two-stop, but last year was held in a sweltering August. But traditionally in the May, the traditional slot in the calendar that this one is, it's usually a one-stop. Mercedes wasn't so sure because they'd seen signs in 2019 that this wasn't an easy one-stop. So let's just plan around having the flexibility of being able to move that way if required. With Bahrain very much in mind, and you recall how one of the key components to beating Red Bull there was them selecting two sets of the harder tyre, whereas Red Bull just had one set and one of the soft. Exactly the same here. They did the same here. Merck had two sets of mediums available, Red Bull only one, which wouldn't have mattered if it had been a one-stop, but it did matter because it sort of migrated towards a two-stop. And what I was referring to earlier on about Max leading the first stint, ending up being his downfall, was that once he was in the lead, he set a pace that was not, in hindsight, appropriate for a one-stop. It was appropriate for the sort of deg, it would have been appropriate for a one-stop for the sort of deg levels that we'd seen on Friday, but today they were much higher. And because he set off like that, he guaranteed the race became a two-stop because Lewis went with him, and that built up such a gap over the others, apart from Bottas, who was obviously playing on Lewis's side, that it later allowed Lewis the gap to drop into to do the Budapest 2019 trick of coming out of Mud Hot with much faster tyres, with a lot of laps still to go, and it sort of trapped Verstappen into that role. But the Red Bull has generally got a higher degradation rate than the Mercedes. It switches its tyres on faster, which is a boon around the outlaps, in and outlaps. But it does eat them up faster as well. And that was the story of this race. So when Max says, we had a slower car, yes, they did, but not over a single lap. Over a single lap, there was nothing in it. But over a stint, yeah, the Red Bull was definitely slow.
Andrew Shovelin sort of described it as the sort of emerging trend looks like Mercedes cars a bit more neutral in terms of it doesn't stress either axle. Whereas obviously, as Mark was just explaining there, it looks like over a race stint, especially the Red Bull does. And I think that it's hard to say the writing was on the wall, because obviously this Barcelona and track position is so important, but the longer Hamilton was able to hang on during that first stint, basically just glued to the gearbox of the Red Bull, it's difficult not to watch that and think, well, the Mercs got this, because every other year we're here, and you saw it further down the order as well, you see cars really, really struggling to stay close. And I know that Hamilton has got this almost freakish gift of being able to drive behind other cars and not struggle so much. I just thought it was really, really telling, a good sign of that fundamental Merc advantage in race trim, that he was able to do that. And ultimately that set him up, didn't it, to deploy the flexibility that Mercedes earned itself on the strategy.
Now, here's a question on strategy, because I was saying to you during the race, Scott, that I felt Mercedes should have taken that opportunity after Max Verstappen had made the initial stop. And then, of course, they left Hamilton out rather than bringing him in on the following lap. It looked like they could probably have brought him in and got him back out ahead, because obviously Verstappen's stop was a little bit slow. And I think that was a valid way to win the race, because if you get track position, they'd still have been able to win. They'd have had tyre parity at that point. But it was an interesting question as to whether that would have worked as well. But also, there is the question of exactly what happened with that Red Bull pit stop. You asked Max Verstappen about exactly what went on there, because there seemed to be some uncertainty about whether he was meant to stop or expected, which led to that loss of a couple of seconds in the pit stop.
Yeah, well, basically, there was a suggestion, I think, that I think it came from Helmut Marko, who said that Red Bull hadn't been expecting Verstappen to stop. So I quickly went back onto Max's onboard and watched the three laps up to his pit stop, and he didn't ever get a call to box. So I don't know if they had some kind of agreement pre-race, or there was some kind of hidden meaning to one of the other messages that was relayed, and that meant that he knew on this lap I will need to pit. But basically there was a misunderstanding, because Red Bull wasn't ready for him, and I think was it the left rear, I think, that was I think one of the rear tyres, I think, wasn't out quick enough. Basically they recovered it quite well, I think. If you've got a car come in for a pit stop and you're not expecting it, and you ultimately do that pit stop in 4 seconds or whatever it was, that's still a pretty good effort, isn't it? But yeah, basically just a small error ultimately. I know that didn't cost them anything at the time. And I don't know whether this is correct, because obviously I don't have the data they have, but Shovelin said that basically by the time Hamilton got to turn 10 after Max had stopped, they felt that they weren't going to come out ahead. So they didn't want to just replicate the first stint, basically. So they kept him out. And ultimately, that then set them on a course where Hamilton extends his stint by a few laps. So when he does come out, he's obviously a few seconds behind. So it didn't cost Verstappen track position. But it is another error, isn't it, that Red Bull has made. And it could have been costly. And nobody's doing a perfect job at every race. And Hamilton, be sort of banging this drum until basically the title's decided. Hamilton got away with an enormous mistake at Imola. So it's not that Mercedes is perfect and Red Bull sucks, but there is definitely a trend now of Red Bull and Verstappen between them leaving things on the table, and they got away with that one there, and then ultimately they didn't have the performance anyway. So I think it is something that they need to work out, because every weekend there just seems to be a little thing that they're not getting quite right.
Ultimately, as you say, if Shovlin's correct and they have some quite good live tools, they certainly shouldn't have stopped if there wasn't a good chance of getting Hamilton out ahead. But Mark, you felt that maybe Verstappen, actually, even though that pit stop did cost time, might actually have been fairly well judged by him, even if he wasn't expected.
Yeah, the tyres fell off, basically, on that lap. So he'd lost 0.4 the previous lap after having been really consistent up to that time. And you could see, yeah, the tyres are beginning to go. But then apparently they really went on the next lap. And it was partway through that lap that whatever signal had been arranged, he told them. So he's, you know, effectively, I'm coming in this lap. So I don't think you'd call it a mistake as such. It was just they got caught out by how sudden the drop-off was.
Well, whatever, you can certainly say it was a great battle at the front and fascinating, as you say, Mark, that you can trace it all the way back to what seemed like a very, very good thing for Verstappen at the first corner, would actually set the race on a path for Hamilton and Mercedes to win it the way that they did. Well, Scott, we talked about one Red Bull driver. We haven't talked about the other one. Sergio Perez finished fifth from eighth on the grid. He was kind of missing from qualifying, wasn't he? What went wrong there?
Well, he had basically a mystery shoulder problem that he said he started to feel some kind of complaint in one of his shoulders at the start of Q1 that he said then got worse as qualifying progressed, but he didn't know where he'd come from because he said he didn't think he'd done anything out of the car, but he also didn't say yes and there was something sticking out of my seat or there was something wrong with the seat that was causing him a physical discomfort in the car. So it was a bit weird, and it was just he didn't look comfortable when we spoke to him after qualifying. So he said that was his most difficult, his worst qualifying session so far of the year. And remember, he got knocked out of Q2 in Bahrain. So he was, I think, physically hurting. And he had a spin on his first run in Q3. So just a really horrible qualifying session. And then once you're starting there, down there in Barcelona, you're fundamentally limited. So unfortunately, it was a case of damage limitation for him individually. But Mark's probably in a better place to explain how big a loss that meant he was for Red Bull in terms of Verstappen's race at the front.
Yeah, it was significant because he wasn't there. So that meant he was stuck. I mean, he was stuck behind Ricciardo's McLaren, wasn't he, in sixth place? So it meant that gap was there for Hamilton to drop into. So he could do that strategy. And otherwise, if Perez had been right there, and he would have dropped behind Perez by making a second stop, then he couldn't have made it. So Bottas was always in the window. If Verstappen had wanted to do it, Bottas was always there. So he was a very useful part of the overall strategy of the team. But Perez's, I think he started eighth, and he qualified eighth, ran sixth. So you soon fall a long way behind when you're at the pace of a McLaren and there's a Red Bull and Mercedes out front. So, yeah, it meant he couldn't really contribute to the overall attempt at winning the race.
Yeah, and fifth place was a reasonable result in the end from that position, but it just shows how important it is for those second drivers to be in play. Over the radio, I think Bono mentioned to Hamilton it was like Hungary 2019. And if you remember, a key element there was that Hamilton and Mercedes could take that free pit stop because Gasly wasn't far enough up the road to be in the pit window. And same thing this time. And it shows how important it is for that second driver. But we should talk about the other Mercedes second driver, Mark, because Bottas was sort of in the mix, not fully in the battle for the top two, but he was at least there in pit windows. But there was a really interesting moment on lap 52 when Hamilton came up to pass Bottas for second. Didn't impact the result, but it did briefly hinder Hamilton's chase of Verstappen. Actually ended up losing 0.3 to Verstappen on that lap. What did you make of that? It seemed that it's not even necessarily what he did for the move in turn 10, but just the fact he didn't let him go that little bit earlier in the lap.
Yeah, I mean, he would have let him go down the main straight into turn one. But there's a couple of things. One, Lewis didn't quite manage to get DRS on him, so he wasn't quite within a tenth on the detection point. And the other thing is Bottas was trying to pull out enough time over Leclerc to be able to do his second stop and emerge in front. So there was two things going on there, and it's very difficult, to judge. Is a guy 9/10 behind? Where's he going to be? How much do I have to lift off when you're in the middle of trying to open out your own gap? So there was that, and it when you looked at how much it actually cost Hamilton, it was about 0.6, I think, or no, it was 1.6. But it's in the end, it didn't impact the result at all.
I think it was not ideally handled either, because Hamilton said afterwards he didn't know that Bottas had been told not to hold him up. So that meant that Hamilton was having to make his own judgment about the body language of the car in front. And if you're doing that, that means at some stage, unless Bottas does quite literally exit stage right or stage left, then Hamilton's got to make a guess on what Bottas is doing, which then leads to him potentially taking a risk to launch an overtake and them tripping up over one another. So that probably could have been handled a little bit better with an explicit message to say, Valtteri, you need to let Lewis pass. Don't hold Lewis up. Let him pass here. And then a message to Lewis to say, Valtteri will let you pass at turn X. And that didn't happen. But I have to admit, at the time, I did feel quite strongly that it was a bit of Valtteri wanting to prove a point, basically, and make it just needlessly difficult. On reflection, maybe I'd sort of soften that stance a little bit, because I do have sympathy that he had his own race. So I would probably revise my initial opinion and say that this was more Bottas being aware that he had to play the team game, but not going out of his way to do it.
I think the point you make about the team could have been more explicit is important. And we've seen loads of teams do this because they don't want to be played around the world on the radio saying, let them pass, because it's team orders. You get all these sort of coded messages, oh, don't hold him up, this, that, and the other. Just say it. Just make it really clear. Look, this is critical for our race to victory. Make sure you don't cost him any time, because
you look more stupid if they crash, don't you? Because yeah, they've not had a clear instruction than you do by telling them, don't crash, let him through.
And never give drivers plausible deniability, because they will use it. Bottas, after all, wants to show that he's a serious contender. He wants to, he might be needing to show to other teams that he's a guy that they want, because he's got that fight. Because if Mercedes don't keep him, he's still a great option for other teams for next year. So he's got to think of himself a little bit. And if you give him that leeway, ultimately it didn't matter in the grand scheme of things, but an interesting little moment. But Scott, let's look a little bit further down. Ferrari was the closest challenger to Mercedes and Red Bull, both in qualifying in the race. That's the first time that's happened this year on both days of a weekend. Charles Leclerc, great fourth place. Ahead of Perez, how upbeat do they seem to be about their performance level now?
Yeah, very. Very happy with the race performance in particular. We've seen in every qualifying session so far that car is quick over one lap. It has been the third fastest car over one lap, but it has often faded in the race, or at least been outgunned by McLaren. But there was something about it here that the Ferrari was just working very well, and the McLaren didn't quite seem to have the rear grip to challenge it. Lando Norris was sort of saying that basically when the Ferrari's chasing a little bit, which they have done in previous races, they end up basically overworking the tyres, trying to keep up with the McLaren, basically, which then allows the McLarens to run their own race. Whereas it was almost roles reversed here. The McLarens didn't quite have what Ferrari had, and actually Leclerc was able to just basically disappear over the course of the race. A crushing victory in that midfield fight. Did a tremendous job to mug Bottas. He made Bottas look quite silly on the first lap, actually. Bottas admitted that he just basically hadn't noticed that Leclerc was that close behind him and got done around the outside of turn three, and then Leclerc held him behind for a while. And because Perez was obviously making his way through, but chiefly because Leclerc had that performance and didn't have the tyre problems that they've suffered at other races, was able to keep quite comfortably clear of the Red Bull as well. So it was, it was really good. And if you look at sort of how much this team has progressed on last year, I know we were expecting them to make a step, but if you remember after testing and going into Bahrain, we weren't massively convinced that they were in a position to be properly third best. And they were sort of saying on Friday, Saturday in Bahrain for the Grand Prix that they were expecting to struggle a little bit more, which indicated that they weren't expecting to be a clear third best either. Now, for the first time, they had the third fastest car in qualifying, the third best car in the race. And they looked every inch here like a team that is ready to sort of hold their own as third best. So I think it's going to be a brilliant fight with McLaren for at least the next few races to see who's got the edge.
And Mark, we also saw another very fine Charles Leclerc qualifying performance. It's an interesting one because he didn't get through Q1 on one set of tyres, so he only had one run on the fresh softs in Q3. And in the worst conditions, he managed to get ahead of his teammate Carlos Sainz in particular, who had two sets of fresh softs. And I think even though Carlos out-qualified him in those strange conditions in Portugal, he's great at adapting. I think Carlos has got a real battle on his hands when it comes to that Saturday performance that Leclerc has. And of course, that made the difference in the race. Leclerc fourth, Sainz a good run to seventh, but obviously not as strong as his teammate in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the fact that Carlos, he got within, what was that, I think, a tenth of Leclerc. I think that's says pretty much that he's made great progress in adapting to the car. So I think if he's at that stage already, I think he's doing very well, because Leclerc is one of the very quickest guys out there, on his day the quickest, I think. So yeah, I think Carlos is making great progress. He's taken the competition, you know, the internal competition to Charles, and I think it's a healthy competition as well. They're very respectful of each other, and as we touched on last time, they've got different approaches, but I think that gives the team greater bandwidth.
Yeah, and just a cracking lineup all round in terms of the skill sets, abilities, execution. That's really going to put them in good stead. If they are in this fight for third in the Constructors' Championship, which certainly all the evidence says they are, that lineup's going to work really well for them. And in that battle, of course, is McLaren, Scott. You've been following Daniel Ricciardo's progress very closely this weekend. Perhaps a little fortunate to outqualify Norris, but the performance is definitely coming for him, as shown by the sixth place in the race. And you've looked very, in great deal of detail, at how he's been chipping away and what the limitation he's been working to eliminate is.
Yeah, sometimes it's just nice to be able to utilize, and this isn't one of the adverts, but in F1 TV, you do have a great resource in being able to ride on board with any of the drivers. So sometimes I quite like to pick one driver and follow them for as far into the weekend as I can. And with Ricciardo, that was every lap he did in practice and every lap in qualifying as well. And it was because he earmarked this weekend as a sort of, he said no excuses, because it's a known quantity, grippier track, more settled conditions. So a chance to actually work out where he is and where he needs to improve. And he started the weekend struggling. I know that McLaren had a lowly Friday because they were evaluating the new front wing and the new floor, but they didn't have a lot of performance. And Ricciardo in particular was struggling quite a lot. And there was so much live in-car coaching from Tom Stallard, his engineer. You just don't... We always hear things like, oh, try this gear at this corner, or brake 10 metres later at turn one, or all these kind of things. But I've never heard anything on the radio like the amount of brake pressure coaching that Ricciardo was getting, being told that he's there's too much brake pressure in phase three, need to apply more brake pressure in phase one, having it described as, you know, try to create a more stabby brake profile. So basically he was being told, try and put more brake pressure on the entry to the corner, get off the brakes earlier, because basically he was inducing understeer into the car. And this was pretty much after every single run through practice and even into qualifying, which to me said that Ricciardo is quite clearly having to consciously think about adjusting his braking technique, which, again, in addition to being an intense level of in-car coaching that I personally haven't heard to that degree before, it's a very fundamental skill or technique for an F1 driver to still be in a position where they're not doing it automatically. And to hear that, I was absolutely fascinating. I got Ricciardo to talk about it after qualifying, and also got technical director James Key's perspective from a technical side, and there'll be a piece on the race website between now and Monaco sort of diving into that in more detail. But what that showed to me was, I think Ricciardo's got tremendous humility to be able to take that on. And he sort of described it as basically feeling like he's back at school and having a tutor saying, yep, good job, you've done that well, now how about you try to do this a little bit better? Okay, you've done that a little bit better, now could you try and work on this? And ego could get in the way there as an F1 driver. Could be, feel a bit embarrassing and feel like he turns his nose up and says, no, I know what I'm doing. But there's none of that. He's getting his head down. He's doing the work that he needs to do. That was shown with constant progress through practice. He did a good job in qualifying. Yes, perhaps a bit lucky to out-qualify Norris, but he got the performance was very close. And then he drove an outstanding race. He grabbed a couple of positions early on, and he just did a really solid job thereafter. Never looked like slipping down the top 10. Quite enjoyed pushing the car to the limits, and just I thought it was his best drive of the season so far, and he felt the same.
It's interesting you mentioned Tom Stallard, his race engineer. I'm always impressed with the way he works with drivers. Everything I hear about him and what I've heard, obviously, he worked with Carlos Sainz before, Stoffel Vandoorne, Jenson Button. The standard fact about him, and why not have this as a standard fact, because it is quite remarkable, he's an Olympic silver medalist, rower at the 2008 Olympics. But I think he works really well with drivers, and I think that race engineer-driver dynamic is so interesting, and it's great to see it working and the detail that they go to. And very impressed overall. Mark, Lando Norris for the first time, not best of the rest. Obviously, he basically ended up in a traffic jam, didn't he? So just one of those weekends for him. He had a bit of bad luck in qualifying with that Mazepin blocking incident, which maybe Mazepin was a little bit unlucky to get a punishment for because he wasn't the only one in that queue, although he did go. But that led to him using the two sets in Q1, which cost him down the line in Q3. But just one of those annoying Sundays for Lando, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he would have been deeply impressive if he just pulled out the mega lap on that one Q3 run on new tyres that he had, but it didn't quite happen. But his potential pace was, he'd shown earlier in the weekend in the practices. He's potentially, I think, maybe a tenth ahead of Ricciardo. So, yeah, he would have been up there where you'd normally expect to see him, I think, had he had a clear run.
Yeah, an eighth place in the end for him, obviously chasing down the ailing on very old tyres Esteban Ocon in the closing stages of the race. Well, let's talk about Alpine now, Mark. Mixed bag for them, with Esteban Ocon fifth on the grid, but only finishing ninth. Fernando Alonso down in 17th in the race, having started 10th. But given they both tried to make one stoppers work, although Alonso eventually aborted his with a very late pit stop once the tyres fell off a cliff, it was probably more encouraging than the race result suggests in terms of pace, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we wondered if the Portimao thing was a peculiarity of that very unusual track. And so this was more of a real test to see if that was genuine. And it absolutely was. They're absolutely bang on Ferrari's pace in qualifying. I think Ocon was separated from Leclerc by less than a tenth, half a tenth maybe. I think the disappointing race result was a result of being on the wrong strategy. They stuck with a one-stop plan, and it just wasn't the appropriate plan. And Fernando is still struggling to put the Q3 lap together. He's absolutely nip and tuck as quick as Esteban when they're, in practice and when they're in a race stint in clear air. But just still not quite putting the pieces together on the vital Q3 lap.
It was actually quite a good drive from Ocon in the race, given those tyres, and he ended up well off the pace at the end of the race, but managed to hold on to that position when he could easily have dropped out of the top 10. So a decent effort from him. Scott, AlphaTauri, difficult weekend for them. 10th place for Pierre Gasly in the end, but it all started off a bit badly for him with some fairly poor parking.
Normally when you see a message flash up that a driver's under investigation for an out-of-position start, it's pretty slam dunk, isn't it? It's like speeding in the pit lane or something. There's not really going to be any interpretation of that that lets the driver off. But normally, that it is quite easy for those to be sort of shrugged off as, well, these cars they must be impossible to see the grid slot. So I often have a lot of sympathy for drivers who don't quite line up perfectly. And then I saw the onboard of Pierre's effort of getting his car in position, and it was just inexplicably bad. He just basically drove past it. So he knew it was silly. He knew that he'd made a stupid error, and he was really annoyed at himself for doing it. So he wasn't laughing and the team wasn't laughing, but it was, I have to say, from my point of view, it was quite comical to see him just sort of sail past the grid position.
Yeah, and he ended up, came so close to passing Ocon at the end. I think it was just under 0.2 at the line. But yeah, just it's always annoying when a relatively trivial little error has such a big impact on the weekend. 5-second penalty, of course, it got him. But also, Scott, you wrote a piece about Yuki Tsunoda. He was at it again over the radio after struggling a little bit in qualifying. And then, of course, his race didn't last very long. Anyway, it's amazing we've gone four races with him only picking up really that one result in Bahrain.
Yeah, well, he's really highly rated, and this was kind of at the heart of what I wrote after qualifying, because I didn't do it to dig him out or just, pile onto him. He's a rookie, he's only four races in, and he's a very young guy, so he will only improve and he'll only get more mature. And plus, I do think another mitigating factor is, while his English has come on leaps and bounds since he came over from Japan to race in Formula 3 a couple of years ago, he's still a fairly weak second language. So I think we do need to cut him some slack, but it's not necessarily the choice of words that's becoming a bit frustrating now. It's the fact that it's clearly not that he's capable of the odd radio outburst. I don't think he can control it. I think when he gets frustrated, I think he rants. And the thing I always find bizarre is that the the mics, the radio is not always open. If you say something in the crash helmet, it doesn't get broadcast every time. You have to activate the radio to be heard. So even if it's automatic, even if it's an automatic response from him, he makes on some level a conscious decision to let the team hear what he's saying. So if he's venting, that's one thing, because we hear other drivers doing it, but he crossed the line in Spain this weekend because he criticised the car after he failed to get through in qualifying, and then he made that very ill-advised comment on television afterwards suggesting that maybe the cars weren't equal because he was struggling with performance, and he just needs to stamp it out. He did apologise for that, fair play to him for doing so, but he does need to get a bit of control because he's got such fantastic potential, and this is why we're all so excited about him and why Red Bull's so excited about him. But it's not going to be a permanent thing, but he does risk spoiling it at the moment because the results aren't there. He's not hooking it all up and he's not endearing himself to many people inside the team or outside of it. If he spends more time or he's more known for being critical and complaining than he is drilling into what the problem is or you know, accepting responsibility. But one thing you obviously have to say is he's absolutely zero responsibility for what happened to him on Sunday when it just looked like where the car just died on him, didn't it? He there was nothing he could have done there, and there was no sweariness or nastiness over the radio. So no, nothing wrong on Sunday, just it was all localised to Saturday.
Yeah, I get the impression, as you would expect for a rookie, he's just not really got to grips with getting the tyres working for that qualifying lap. It was very tricky, Barcelona, as well, to do that. But numerous times we've heard him say no grip in qualifying, and I suspect that was what it was down to. But also, Mark, AlphaTauri, they look really good in the first two weekends. The last two haven't gone so well. So do we think they're kind of slipping out of that lead trio in the midfield? Because it was them, McLaren and Ferrari, as the three standouts in the midfield. But Alpine seems to have swapped places with them almost.
Yeah, indeed. It's very very stark, the difference, Portimão here to the first two races. And they weren't expecting to be very good in Portimão. But they were expected to be good here. So that's a little bit worrying. Let's see if it's exposing something that's fundamental, or whether it's just they didn't hit the sweet spot of the car this weekend or what. But we'll see in subsequent races. But it looks a long way away from the team that really on pace could go bat to bat with Ferrari and McLaren in the first two races.
Yeah, it's making those lack of results from the first two doubly costly, you would argue. Aston Martin, talking of strugglers, we had standard issue moaning from team principal Otmar Szafnauer about how the regulations have hurt Aston Martin because they weren't implemented properly the way that they were decided. But given both drivers now had the floor upgrade, this race really does show how hard-pressed that team is to score now, doesn't it? Just outside the top 10 with both drivers at the end of the race.
Yeah, that's its level, isn't it? The upgraded floor that was on Seb's car this race, which Lance had had on the previous race, so it's now on both cars. I think that is worth a genuine couple of tenths, and it did look that way. But that's only just maintaining them in that sort of Q2, Q3 cutoff. It's a long way from where they were at with the pink Mercedes last year. So. Yeah, they say, we hear the line about how the regulations have impacted more on the low-rate cars, and I'm sure that is true. I'm sure they have, and there are quite good technical explanations as to why that might have been. But, we're seeing a Mercedes win three out of the first four races and be contenders everywhere, so it's not impossible to make a low-rate car competitive. So they're still a much smaller entity than Mercedes, and it's more difficult developing a concept from a difficult position than it is just assuming a ready-made quick car. And we're just seeing that play out, I guess.
Yeah, it's going to be a long, hard season at this rate. Lance Stroll was 11th, Sebastian Vettel 13th. Either side of Kimi Raikkonen was 12th. Kimi Raikkonen had that reverse strategy, so we say. He started on the mediums, went long, and went to the softs. Pretty good result for Alfa Romeo. The interesting one was George Russell in the Williams. I was sort of keeping an eye on Williams' progress as the race went on, because it did become apparent they had half a chance of a of a point in this race. Didn't happen because Russell's tyres fell off a cliff and he never managed to quite get past Alonso, who was the bottleneck there that he'd have needed to do earlier to do it. But what I was quite impressed with is I may not have been on the money with my live commentary on the Mercedes strategy, where I thought they should have taken that pit stop, but I was really impressed that they responded to the Alfa Romeo pit stop problem and brought both cars in and double stacked them under the safety car, because that was basically a free position. They realised that they could pit, drop behind the two Hasses, who wouldn't have been a problem to repass anyway, but get ahead of Giovinazzi. And that was just the start of putting them on this sort of semi-offset strategy, which I thought was really sharp from Williams and bodes well for them. But less good for Alfa Romeo and Antonio Giovinazzi. A damaged valve led to the fact they attempted to put a tyre that had lost pressure onto the front left, and that really compromised his race as well. But yeah, it's really hard work for these teams to get points, though, isn't it, Mark? They really need a smooth weekend to be able to do it, or a little bit of strategic unusualness.
Yeah, I mean, the competitive order is really quite clear. It's quite clear which teams are in which group. So you've got five teams. They're going to fill up, if everything just goes on merit, you've got five teams that are going to fill up the points places. So, yeah, if you're outside of there, it's you know, those 2 or 3 tenths deficit in qualifying, you're never going to grab them back unless there's some unusual circumstance, the wet race or an accident or something like that. So yeah, it is very, very tough, and in this season in particular, when you everyone's looking towards 2022, you'd think the chances of them developing their way into the next group up are pretty slim. So yeah, it's going to be pretty meager pickings for those teams, I think, for the rest of this year.
And just before we finish off, Scott, coming back round to where we began with the battle at the front, this run of four races, it's kind of the first stanza of the championship battle. Three wins for Hamilton, one win for Verstappen, a 14-point lead in the championship for Hamilton, and then, of course, Mercedes, a healthy little lead in the Constructors' Championship as well. It's been a really solid foundation for Mercedes, and I think it shows how strong a team and driver combination that is. We've been talking about this when they've been dominant, about how well they're executing, but this has really shown, even when they're pushed, they've got a lot of tricks, a lot of performance, the ability to pull these results out of the bag consistently.
Yeah, I hope that people are enjoying this and what we're seeing as much as I am, because part of me does worry that because Hamilton and Mercedes have just kept on winning, that maybe what we're actually seeing is being lost a little bit, because this is an awesome fight. We go into every weekend not really knowing who's going to be quickest. You go into qualifying and I think the last three qualifying sessions have been decided by hundredths, if not thousandths of a second, which is just, that's phenomenal. As I said at the very beginning, we've got a 100% record at the moment this season with Hamilton and Verstappen going wheel to wheel. And Hamilton and Mercedes are having to dig deep in different ways to win. So we're seeing why Hamilton is the most successful driver statistically of all time. We're seeing why he should be regarded as one of the greatest of all time. And we're seeing why Mercedes has dominated this era the way it has, and it has never tripped up, because it is capable of rising to every challenge. Right now, we're seeing it rise to probably the fiercest on-track challenge it's had. I know that the Ferrari fight got quite tasty at times, but I really do think that this is becoming quite a special season. And yeah, it looks like the Mercedes might have an edge on Sundays. I'm not going to say that makes it easier, but obviously it does set them up for these kind of performances. But it's just fascinating, and I'm really, really enjoying it. It's so much more enjoyable to see a Mercedes, especially Hamilton, win when they've been made to work for it. And I think it's fair to say that every win they've scored this season, they have absolutely been made to work for it.
Well, and as Mark always explains in his race analysis, it's tiny things that make the difference in this battle. And that's all we really ask for in a championship fight. Probably have to go back to 2012 for the last proper two-team fight for the championship with Alonso and Vettel. Yeah, Ferrari is sort of threatened at times, but they've never gone the distance. And so this is probably the best championship we've had for almost a decade, based on a sample set of four out of maybe 23 races.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's going to go down as one of the great seasons, the vintage season. We're a little early to really see the patterns after just four races, but I'm not one to make predictions, because you're informed about something doesn't make you any better at predicting than just you know, an averagely interested bystander, really. But I think we're looking at Monaco, looking ahead to Monaco. I've just got a feeling that the Red Bull is going to trounce the Mercedes around her.
not one for predictions, but here's a massively bold prediction.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why I prefixed it, because I don't know. There is a logical justification for it, which might not turn out to be the case, but I have a feeling it will. And I'm looking forward to, because that's just going to put a slightly different complexion on it. Because at the moment, 3 out of 4 for one of the teams and 1 out of 4 for the other just makes it sound way less evenly matched than it really is. And I think if we can assess it after Monaco, see where they, I think we'll have a much more realistic idea of where they really stack up.
Well, that's the great thing this year. It is going to hopefully swing back and forth. And yeah, predictions are largely fairly pointless, but the real value they have is, it's if you have a model of what you think's going on, comparing what happens against your expectations is a great way to try and learn a little bit more. And that's what it's all about. Every race weekend, we learn a little bit more about Mercedes and Red Bull. We learn a little bit more about Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen, and we're going to learn a hell of a lot more about them before this season is out. So if you'd like to learn even more, do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. Loads to read there. Mark Hughes' race analysis, my ever-controversial driver ratings, and also Scott Mitchell. Plenty of stuff there. I think you're working on a piece on Lewis Hamilton's performance in the key pressure points so far this year. If you haven't already done so, make sure you subscribe to this podcast, and if you're so minded, leave a review on your podcast platform of choice. And don't forget to have a look at our YouTube channel, just search for The Race. So with 4 races down and Hamilton and Verstappen crossing swords on track in every one of them, really is turning into a season F1 has long been waiting for. So stick with us on The Race F1 podcast so you don't miss a thing.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a 1-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.